everybody. Welcome to podcast number 47 of the Alexis L podcast. Now, this may in some ways seem a bit niche, the subject matter that we cover today, but I also think it's the most important thing ever in the history of the world. So, you know, somewhere, you know, treat it like that. It's also, I suppose, I've made my part of my career, part of my work has always been mocking the idiocies of the left, really, the splits and the kind of ridiculous jargon. And that was all fine and good in a time when what the baddies called in a Transformers movie, they the Decepticons.
Decepticons, yeah.
Yeah, that was when the Decepticons went coming for us. Now I think this is a moment when I think that left party, some form of left party or left parties, needs to stand in the general election and in coming by-elections in the future. I think now I don't think that just to concentrate on parliamentary politics is the way forward. That I think the new left parties party needs to be both a campaigning organization. But it also, I think they don't take you seriously if you don't also have members of parliament. So I think that it has to be my feeling is that if we are going to save ourselves from the aliens out of Independence Day who are coming to rule us, then we really need to get our shit together and have a party or parties that follow that twin track approach.
Well, actually having bums and seats in the House of Commons.
Yeah, I think you have to. I think that has to be a part of it. I mean, I guess.
Yeah. Anarchist. But when we talk about, sorry to interrupt, but when we talk about, we need a new party that actually represents us.
Yeah.
You always imagine in your head like, oh, okay, they'll take up a third of parliament. And that's such a, you know, that's like an unrealistic or sign of like, you don't imagine that actually being possible.
Yeah.
Right. And, yeah. But it doesn't have to be. You know, 100 seats, does it?
No. Well, I think Dr. Edmund Griffiths makes it clear what the aim should be, certainly in the short to medium term in the interview, really. And, I mean, anarchist groups would probably argue that the campaigning for parliamentary votes is completely pointless and just, you know, it's that you have to fight for a kind of revolution and take over the means of production. And I don't know. I just, you know, you might be right, but I think that we've got to try this approach. You've got to go for parliamentary seats as well as campaigning. I became distracted for a minute there because for some reason Wilf started squawking. Yeah. And Wilf does make a brief, he makes a point at the start about, I think he is a kind of anarchist, really.
He's been piping up a lot recently.
Yeah, he's got very squawky, right? Yeah, he makes a brief intervention, but then he settles down to listen to the debate. And I think he said afterwards he found it fascinating, and he's shifted his views to some extent.
In a nutshell, Alexi, what's this interview about? This coming up.
So I read this, I mean, I say it in the body of the podcast, but I read this article that Dr. Edmund Griffiths had written about just about how you campaign, how left parties need to campaign, how they need to bring. Now, in the past, I think they have stood without a level of seriousness. They have stood for, I don't quite understand the motivation for why you would stand for parliament without trying to win the seat, but for whatever reason, left parties have continued done that. And we talk about how that is that has a negative effect. I think it makes people dismiss left thinking, you know, as being unserious and unsustainable. And the truth is, I think probably I say in the podcast, that Britain is a much more left-leaning country than its governments have ever allowed it to be, really. That if you could find a way, and it won't be easy, but the way to get around all those various traps and sabotage, that if you could have a government that offered, in Britain, that did offer left-wing social democratic policies, those would be extremely popular. Instead, what we're going to get is a move to the right by both Labour and Conservative, and I think that also opens the door for the far right, I think. And if we don't do something, that's what we're going to get.
Mm. And in this interview, you hit on some realistic kind of ways at the left can progress.
He's talking about practical things to do, really, which is, you know, that's one of the things. Again, as I think I say in about the other podcast, that, obviously I read lots of articles about the left, you know, and all the points that they make are fine about, you know, colonialism or genocide or the corruption of the stock markets or the growing gap between the
classes, rich
and the poor classes. Mm. Yeah, but what they really, really talk about is how, what are you going to do about it?
Yeah.
And
it's always moan, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, you know, you have to have that. You have to have that knowledge of what it is you're fighting. But you also have to think about how you're going to fight it.
And sitting back and listening to you and Edmund chatting, I felt empowered. You know, it was weird to listen to it. It felt like there was actually a possible way that we can start to change things, and this discourse needs to happen more. It's starting to bubble, I think. I'm seeing a bit of it happening around.
I mean,
our best pal, Owen Jones, has recently said something similar, but his solution is throwing money at campaigns, whereas Edmund
works.
For those who actually are thinking about being more politically active than just, you know, funding a GoFundMe or something, Edmund outlines some really, really good points.
Yeah, no, I think I don't know. I think what he says is really important. And I think that, I mean, we have collectively, I think we have felt so powerless over the last, since the rise of Starmer, particularly obviously over the last 6 months, when we've seen the monster in all its awfulness. You know, we've seen what they will do if you get in their way in Gaza. That's an object lesson in who they are and what they will tolerate, really. And, you know, in the face of that enormous machine, one has felt powerless. And I think that this is what he says, what we say is, at least the start of a way of thinking of somehow fighting back, I think.
Wicked.
Roll tape. we record all this on 4-track tape recorder.
Yeah.
And it's cool.
Hold on, I just got to turn the cassette over to do the interview. There we go. Press play and record at the same time. And action.
So I have a feeling that there is a space opening up in terms of left politics that the general election, I think that there's possibility of independent left candidates standing, and then also once there is a Starmer government, that they will be so fucking awful that when the opportunity arises and there are by-elections, that independent candidates will hopefully be able to stand and succeed in a way that, Galloway kind of showed the way. I'm also terribly worried, though, that somehow, in some way, the left is going to entirely fuck this up. As a consequence of that, I read a really interesting article. It was actually on the Jewish Voice for Labour site, but it was originally written for the website or a publication called Communist News, and it was written by Dr. Edmund Griffiths, and I just thought it was full of wisdom and insight about, it was called, what was it called, Edmund?
How we should contest.
How we should contest the general election. Yeah. And it was just seemed to me it was full of wisdom about the practicalities of contesting a general election, what left parties need to do to actually be successful, not to stand and lose their bleeding deposits, as so many of us have done in the past. But I think we can't afford to throw away this opportunity now. There is a real, we owe it to the world in a way not to fail this time, because otherwise we are, I think, heading into irredeemable authoritarian darkness. And the only bastion between that and the world is really is left party. So I don't know. Welcome, Dr. Griffith. And can you give us a flavour, really, of how this, I guess, how it came about and what the article, your messages it contains?
Well, yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me on, Alexei. This article is about how the left could contest elections, because I think we all kind of know deep down that putting up candidates and getting 200 votes in a constituency or getting 0.5% is demoralizing. It puts people off.
Yet the left has endlessly done it, really.
Yeah.
God knows what fucking reason.
Yeah, the left continues to do this. And I mean, I've voted for those candidates. I've campaigned for those candidates. But I think there is, as you say, a space there, but that doesn't turn into political support, that doesn't turn into votes, just of its own accord.
Well, shut up. Sorry, that's cool.
And so in this article, which actually, it starts out not as an article, but a talk for a discussion group that I'm part of, and then I wrote it up as an article in the Weekly Worker. The
original Weekly Worker, that's right. Sorry, that's out of the publication.
The original title of the talk was "There's a General Election Coming Up." Not very inspiring. but I suppose one key point that I'm trying to make in the article is we don't get much media coverage. We don't get our publicity work done for us by the tabloid press, and that means we need to go out and do the work on the doorstep, door-to-door canvassing, which, you know, the Tories don't need to do. Tories don't do much canvassing door-to-door, because everybody's heard of the Tory party already. They've got the Mail and the Telegraph and whatever else helping them get their message out. We don't have that, and we're not going to have that. So you need, if you want people to vote for you, you need to go door to door.
Absolutely.
And in a constituency, the typical constituency is 70,000 or 75,000 people, and that's 40,000 households. So on average, it's about 40,000 front doors you've got to knock on if you want to meet the voters. And to do that needs a lot of people who are prepared to put serious time in. If it takes 5 minutes to knock on a door, and that's a bit of a guess. I mean, I don't know how long it takes, but if it takes 5 minutes to knock on a door, then you can do 12 in an hour, one person. You can do 120 in 10 hours. And 10 hours is a long stint, and you haven't got very far towards your 40,000 that you're trying to cover over a kind of 6-week election campaign. So it works out if you've got 100 people who are prepared to do 5 or 6 hours a week each, you can cover it.
Right.
If you've got much less than that, you're going to end up doing what the left usually does, which is you put up a stall in the town centre and you meet people who pass by the stall. But anybody who wasn't doing their shopping in town that Saturday never really finds out you exist.
Yeah, and that kind of procedure is completely pointless, because it also says, I think what you're saying to the punter really is, if you just, as you say, putting up, is saying you're not serious, isn't it, really?
Yeah, exactly that. And sometimes these organisations are not really trying. I mean, perhaps they're trying to promote something to a relatively small number of people. I know there was a left party, I'm not going to name the party, but a left party that stood in my constituency several elections ago. And my dad was visiting, And he saw their stall in the street. And he said to them, oh, I don't live here. I can't vote for you. But my son lives here. And he's voting for you. And they said, are you sure? What's his name? That is not a party that's trying to get to to the 70,000 people who live in that constituency.
No.
And when it ends up getting 100 votes or 150 votes or whatever it ends up getting, it makes the whole left look fringe.
Yeah.
It means that if there's people who were out there who maybe liked the message and thought, yeah, that does make sense, but am I wasting my time? Is this just like monster raving lunacy?
Yeah.
And then it gets that very small vote and they think, God, yeah, no, it really is fringe. I really am the only nutter who thinks this.
Yes. Yeah.
So I think you've just got to stand candidates where you've got enough activists to put the work in. And if you haven't, then you're not actually making the argument. You're not getting to the voters.
Right.
And thing that left groups typically say when they stand is, oh, yeah, but we got a much more, the small vote that we got, that doesn't reflect that we got a much more favorable response on our stall. Well, yeah, you probably did, because on your stall you met 30 people.
Right.
They might have all voted for you, but all the people you did not meet never knew what you were about, and they didn't vote for you.
Yeah. And we talked a little bit about, one of the things that I found impressive about the article was it sort of, you referenced a party which I'd been sort of interested in, which was the Northern Independence Party. And they, I'd kind of expected better things of them, I think, if you'd like to talk a bit about them, really. As epitomizing, I mean, in some ways, they weren't the epitome of kind of doer kind of left politics, because they were witty and stuff like that. But as it turns out, that didn't help.
Yeah. This was an interesting example. This was people who I think generally they had been Corbyn supporters and they were disappointed by it. And Barley's kind of defines, yeah, well, Northern Independence Party. And they brought out a kind of anti-austerity manifesto. And what they were brilliant at was social media. They were really funny online and they attracted a lot of attention. And I mean, some of this was happening during the COVID pandemic, and people were not out and about, but they were looking at their screens. And the Northern Independence Party seemed like something fresh. It seemed they had something that works very well online. Just go, oh, we're joking, but are we?
Right.
Even the headline about independence for Northern England, sometimes it was difficult to tell. Do they really want to go through with that, or is that just a way of making the point that the North gets ignored?
Yeah.
And they did that very effectively. And for the first time, they stood an election candidate. It was a by-election in Hartlepool. They got Thelma Walker, who'd been a Labour MP under Corbyn.
Yeah, nice woman.
To be their candidate, you know, completely, very credible candidate. And they got 250 votes. And then at their next attempt, for Thelma Walker, you could say, well, because they were still going through the electoral commissions, it's electoral commission bureaucracy that makes it difficult to register a new party, especially a small party if you haven't got lawyers and accountants and so on. It makes it difficult. So Thelma Walker was on the ballot paper as an independent.
Right.
But then by the following year, they'd managed to tickle the boxes with the electoral commission, and they put up a proper candidate under their own name, Northern Independence Party, with their logo, 84 votes. So, I mean, nothing.
Yeah.
And I think what you learn from that is that doing it online and doing it in podcasts is not, that doesn't replace really meeting people face to face where they live. It can be useful as well. It can be useful as an auxiliary. It can help. One thing about the Northern Independence Party, it got loads of press coverage. It was written up in the Times, it was in the Guardian, it was in the Independent, which minor parties normally aren't. Those papers would normally turn their nose up at a small party with a left-wing kind of platform.
Absolutely. Mm.
But all those political journalists, they're all on Twitter. If they see that people are excited about it on social media and they're intrigued by it, then they might think this is a big deal and we'll write it up. But it doesn't get through to those thousands of people who are not looking at political social media accounts.
Right. And they're reading The Guardian.
And they're not reading The Guardian. And the for a small party, if you had billionaire funding and so on, then there might be other ways to do it. But for a left party, the only way you're going to do it is having people doing the legwork in the constituency and getting through to people, you know, getting people to put a poster up in their window, because then other people in the street can say, oh, there's somebody else, you know, this is starting to be a bit real. And they'll talk to people they know and say, God, I had that left party come around, knock on my door and say, yeah, I had that as well. Actually, they were making a lot of sense. And some of them won't say they were making a lot of sense. I mean, some people won't agree. A lot of people won't agree, even if they do hear the message. But if we're not even giving them a chance to hear it, then you're not really fighting that election.
No. Do you agree that this is a inflection point, I suppose, that this is the most important kind of, I don't know, dichotomy is not quite the right word, really, but, you know, this is the, we are facing something very real here, and we need to, for the first time in our goddamn political lives, in some ways, we need to act sensibly.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, partly because we've had the Corbyn experience. We've seen what happens, you know, after 100 years of people saying, yeah, but if the left got, if we got a left leader of the Labour Party, then, well, we've now seen what happens. And what happens is that the Labour right fight like animals to stop it and block the left. And the Labour left end up pulling their punches.
Amplify that a bit. Why do you think that is, that they pull their punches?
I mean, I think a lot of them are genuinely committed to the Labour Party as a project.
Idiot.
They really believe, that you hear from Labour left that the bird needs a left and a right wing to fly. They really believe that they are part of the same project with the Labour right. And if the right's in charge, then we might grumble a bit, but we'll go along with it. And if we're in charge, then the right should grumble a bit. The thing is, nobody told the Labour right that that was the deal.
Not at all, no.
And the Labour right have made it clear that they won't, that they won't operate like that.
No.
And from their politics, it's not just because the Labour left are decent, selfless people, and the Labour right are thugs and monsters.
That
might be true.
Yeah.
But also, somebody who's a Blairite, what they want politically really is closer to a One Nation Tory than it is to the Labour left.
Yeah.
So why should they work to put Corbyn in power instead of the Tories? Well, actually, they get more of what they want. A Tory government isn't their first choice, but it's probably their second choice.
Right.
Out of the whereas the Labour left are committed to the idea of a Labour Party, they would all prefer the most right-wing Labour government. I mean, good for them, they're going to get it. The most right-wing Labour government you can imagine. They would always prefer that over the Tories, which means that they won't fight the inner party.
Right.
I mean, this is something that...
I've never heard that insight before, but yeah, it rings true, really.
I mean, I hadn't seen it until Corbynism. I was told years ago by an old left-wing activist, the problem is that in inner party, Labour Party battles, the right always fight to win and the left never does.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, I kind of remembered that as a bit of folklore. I hadn't seen it happen. And then when Corbynism came along, you know, red sky in the morning. I mean, the folklore was right. That is how it happened.
Yes.
And so I think that means that going back to the way people did relate to the Labour Party and think, well, yeah, the right's in charge because the right won the vote, but the left should play along with it. Well, you know, we've tried that.
Yeah.
The right will not allow the left, and you can see how much more tightly controlled the campaign group Labour MPs are now than they were under Tony Blair. Yeah. And Tony Blair was not the famous libertarian in the way he ran the party, but they had far more space then to criticise and to argue.
Do you think Starmer will get rid of them all just before the general election, so that
it wouldn't surprise me at all.
No.
It wouldn't surprise me at all. I don't think that by shutting up, they're necessarily saving themselves.
No, because that's what you can clearly see, that they're keeping their heads down open to make it to the general election.
Yeah, I think they are. And I'm not at all convinced that that's going to work.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it does, you know, the argument for having them in the Labour Party was, oh, well, at least we get to make the arguments. At least we can speak the truth in Parliament and so on. Yeah, but if you never do, because you know that you'll get purged, then what's the point of having?
Yeah. I think it kind of corrupts the soul as well a bit. I think, I don't know about that, but just sitting there being intimidated, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's true, and I think it applies to, I mean, I think probably it was a problem in the Labour left that you saw a bit during Corbynism, that the sort of people who were still around on the Labour left were people who for decades could keep being pushed around and lose the argument and being beaten by the right. People who found that totally unendurable. They either left the Labour Party or they stopped being on the left.
Right.
Plenty of people, you know, Margaret Beckett or whatever, was complete Benite back in the day, but moved right because that was the way of being, of having a voice or whatever.
Getting on in the
black. Yeah. And other people, you know, Scargill couldn't hack it and walked out.
Right.
Once it was clear that his politics was being completely marginalised. And the people who had stayed around up to 2015 were people who hadn't made either of those decisions. But no, I mean, I think in, you know, what you say about it damaging to the soul, I think that's true for people involved in Labour politics. It's true for grassroots members. It's true for people who are considering voting Labour under Starmer. This is a party that goes out of its way to show how much it hates you and hates everything that you stand for.
Yeah.
And it will demonstratively stamp on you, but you're still going to vote for it.
Yeah.
That's not, you know, have some self-respect.
Yeah.
That's not...
Get out now! Yeah.
Exactly. And so for that reason, this is an important election, the turning point. Also, as you hint, turn from both main parties to be increasingly authoritarian, rolling back civil liberties, democratic rights, right to protest, right to free speech, you know, things that were hard won by the left and the Labour movement and others. And it's important to try and fight that and to try and, I mean, ideally extend those democratic rights, but hang on to the ones that we've got as well. hang on to the right to protest.
And so what's best case scenario then? Let's try and look forward to. I mean, what should we do? As Lenin said, what is to be done?
I mean, we're not going to be forming a government after the next election. Best case scenario, I think, is getting, if we could get one or two seats, if we could get some MPs elected on a clear left platform, then there's things that even one or two MPs can do. One or two MPs, they can use Parliament as a platform. They can speak in Parliament without being scared of the Labour whip and all the rest of it. They can ask questions to the government. And the government can still lie. I mean, they can lie or they can refuse to answer. But it's harder to lie to an official question asked by a member of Parliament. And they can also, if we're talking about civil liberties and some right to protest, if you've got left MPs, they can be in the front rank if there's a demo that the police might come and break up. We make them arrest a member of Parliament. And again, they might still do it. They might still arrest a member of Parliament. But it's making it harder for them to say that you're arresting an opposition MP rather than, the players like you and me.
Yeah.
So I think what we want is to get our own MPs elected. And I think this is Lenin as well, to be tribunes, to be a voice, to provide a public voice for our politics and to make the arguments. And it would be great if we could have hundreds. It would be great if we could win a majority. We're not currently at that place. I think there is support there that can be mobilized. But like I was saying, the knocking on doors, the kind of tedious work.
Yeah, but then there are a legion of people, disillusioned Corbyn supporters, who would go anywhere to knock on doors, don't you think? I mean, we do have an army at our disposal if we can find the right people to stand, I think.
We do if we can find the right people to stand, if we can find the right platform for them to stand.
Yeah.
Under if we can make sure that we're mobilizing those people and not spreading the resources too thin.
Yes.
By standing loads of candidates when we're not sure that we can get the activists behind them. It's much better. I mean, the last couple of general elections, most of the far left was supporting Corbyn, supporting Labour. So there were not many candidates standing against Labour from the left. But at the one before that, 2015, just in London, the group of Trade Unionist and Socialist Coalition put up 26 candidates in one city. 26 constituencies is a million front doors to knock on.
Right.
I don't know how many members they've got in London, but I don't think they can knock on a million front doors.
No.
Why not make it one? Why not make it two? And
yes,
really get a proper campaign, active campaign. And this is something that you can learn from Galloway. And I've got a lot of criticisms of Galloway's politics. But one thing that Galloway really gets right is that he campaigns when he's standing for Parliament on a massive scale. He expects to have hundreds of volunteers out knocking on the doors and posters and literature everywhere. And so everybody in that Rochdale by-election, I doubt there were very many people living in Rochdale who did not know that George Galloway was candidate.
Yes.
And that's part of why he wins. But if you compare that to a typical left campaign, which often boils down to a few people in the town centre on a street corner with a collapsible table, giving out a few leaflets. Well, that's part of the reason why why he gets the votes and those other
absolutely attempts.
So picking a comparatively small number of constituencies where you can bring the activists in, like I was saying, in London where there's public transport, you know, it's, you don't have to spread it as thin as that. You can pick a small number of constituencies. I don't know which are the right constituencies. I mean, people on the ground have to decide which are the, where have we got the best chance? Where have we got the best chance of making a breakthrough? And maybe you win the seat and maybe you don't win the seat. You know, maybe you still, it takes a couple of elections to get there. It might well take a couple of elections to get there. That in this election, you get enough of a vote to show that we're serious, to show that we're in the mix, that we're a contender here. And you fight those wards in council elections and so on as well. And then hopefully at the next election, there'll be people, because after 4 or 5 years of Starmer government, there might be quite a swing to the left away from Labour if we're there.
If we're there, because the other thing is that the most likely outcome is a swing to the right, really.
Yeah. I mean, this is a pattern that you see increasingly in the world now, that you have authoritarian neoliberal governments of the centre, and the opposition to them comes from the right or from the far right.
Because those centrist policies inevitably fail, don't they?
Yeah. And so you get, you know, Macron versus Le Pen in France. And that, I think, would suit Tories and Labour and our whole political class down to the ground. They would love it to be Macron versus Le Pen. That's why they tried to build up Leave versus Remain as a kind of Macron-Le Pen or Biden-Trump or whatever. And the left needs to be saying these are not the solutions. And if you hate the Starmer government, you're right to. But the solution to it is not to go even further to the right. And I don't think it's impossible to put that across to people. I don't
know. Well, as has been endlessly stated, Corbyn's policies, when they were put to people without being told that they were Corbyn's policies, were immensely popular, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. And even, I mean, in 2017, the Labour vote went up. And there was
massively.
And something that I think isn't paid enough attention to is that Corbyn did mobilise an extremely broad political coalition. And there were people who supported Corbyn, enthusiastically supported Corbyn, who were very soft left in the Labour Party, or not even soft left. There were people on the right of the Labour Party who hated him and were very effective about that.
Yeah.
But his support reached quite a way to the right of himself, but it also reached to the left of himself. And there were people who had been, or maybe who still were, anarchists or part of different far-left groups, who actually had a lot of time for Corbyn and were mobilised. So it is possible to do it. And it's to do with the specific policies, but it's also to do with the idea that there's another way.
Yeah.
That it doesn't have to be the kind of grinding, increasingly unequal, increasingly undemocratic society that we've all been experiencing, you know, that I've been experiencing my whole life.
Yeah.
And that it might be possible. And we don't know exactly what the alternative would look like, but we can debate what the alternative would look like.
I mean, you had some interesting things to say, I thought, as well, about the offer that left parties need to make to the voters. Because I remember, like, Ken Loach, God bless him, he formed some socialist party or something. And I remember seeing their manifesto, which is this, like, 60-page document. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but, you know, our policy towards the restitution of the Chagos Islands will be, you know, our policy on marine bleaching. You know, I mean, this kind of, I mean, it's like, why are you telling people this? Because it's not like you're not going to be the government.
Yeah, exactly. A party that is intending to win the election and be the government might put out a manifesto with all its detailed policies, and we've got a fully costed manifesto, and we know how this tax is going to pay for this reform and so on. But for left parties, which have never stood in a majority of seats, so even if everybody who physically could vote for the left had decided, which they didn't, but even if they had decided to vote for the left, it would still not have been the government. And when you know that the best case scenario is that we're going to win seats, and we might not, you know, we'd not be depressed with some good results that still fall short of winning seats, then it just, what does it mean to say this is what I would do when I'm chancellor after the election? Well, you're not going to be. I mean, you literally have zero chance. I mean, it looks farcical enough when the Lib Dems put out that kind of manifesto.
Yeah.
But at least they've got the candidates. I mean, they physically could win the election. We can't. So I think mostly you shouldn't waste people's time with that kind of thing, because that's just a fantasy football, isn't it? This is what I would do with this government department. But you can say, these are, you know, this is where we're trying to get to. This is about getting away from capitalist system and moving towards socialism. And I think that's attractive to people.
Absolutely, yeah.
And if you're not, if you're not saying that, then kind of what's the point?
Absolutely, yeah.
So you can say that without saying how every bit of it is going to be funded, because we don't, you know, we're not there. And then you can also say we're not standing to be the government. We know we're not going to be the government. We're standing to be in opposition. We're trying to get to be in a position where we can make our voices heard, where we can strengthen campaigns and protest movements and so on that are happening outside Parliament, because a lot of politics does not, a lot of real politics.
And I think that's another important point. I think that, I mean, I've been saying for a while that whatever left parties are, they have to be working on the ground with protest movements as well, don't they, and community campaigns.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It has to be something that's part of an ongoing movement. And does it benefit this movement to try and get a voice in the political, formal political process, try and get a voice in Parliament? Well, it does benefit.
I think so, yeah.
Does it benefit the movement to stand and not even try and get 100 votes? It doesn't.
No.
It's a setback. But so I think that's the kind of manifesto. Because a manifesto, you know, the Labour or Tory manifesto is saying, it might be completely dishonest, but it's claiming this is what we want to do over the next 4 or 5 years. And if you vote for us and put us in government, well, we'll do it. And I think left parties, rather than having a list of policies, say, well, what are we planning to do over the next 4 or 5 years?
Yes, absolutely.
What do we want to do over the next 4 or 5 years that will at least move things a bit in the way that we want things to go, and try and hold back movement away from, movement in the wrong direction?
Yeah.
And explain to people, how does you voting for us, how does it help? Well, if it gets us a seat, then this is what we're going to do with one seat. And that's like those things of putting the MP where they can get arrested and using Parliament to make speeches and so on. Not saying we'll pass this law, but we won't pass a law. We're not going to be in a position to pass a law. But we'll have an MP who will raise the issues, who will raise the opinions that we want to express, make it harder to keep them completely frozen out of the press and all the rest of it. If we don't even get the seat. But I think you can explain to people, if we get 20%, then that's better than if we only get a couple of percent.
Yes.
I think you can make sense. I think that makes sense to people. I think you can say, look, if we can get a decent, solid vote, if we can get thousands of votes,
yes,
rather than a couple of hundred or a yeah. couple of tens, if we can get thousands of votes, then it means we're showing that there is a real support, that there's a base of support for these ideas. It's building towards the following election. It'll be, it's part of a movement forward. I don't think there's any way, if you're expecting to get, you know, why is getting 150 votes better than 120 votes? It isn't. You can't answer that to somebody. Because there's no, and that's why, as I say, if you're expecting to do that badly, if you think you're at that level of, then don't stand
there. Oh, fuck around, people.
Yeah. I mean, you've got to seem as though you're taking it a bit seriously, as though you're taking yourself seriously.
Yes, yes, exactly, yes. No to dilettanteism. How, one of the things, I don't know if it's your line or, I thought there was an interesting, what's the website at my
school? Weekly Worker.
Weekly Worker. One of the things I seem to read on there was just that, one of the things that we have to finally put an end to in this cycle, or we're done for, is factionalism. I think that this kind of fissiparious nature. You know, this kind of the inclination of the left to split. I think the inclination of the left to split, thinking about it a lot, partly comes from the fact that everybody thinks they're right, don't they, on the left? So they think, if I don't win this argument, or if I don't, my particular point of view doesn't get across, then I'm letting down the working class of the entire world. I'm letting down the anti-colonial struggle because I think one of the things that came across on that site was that we know that generally left policies, anti-colonial policies, anti-capitalist policies are right, but we don't have, none of us has the exact right idea. And anybody, anybody on our side will kind of be better than anybody on their side.
Yeah, I think that's very important. That there's things where none of us actually can be completely sure what the right answer is. And there's also things, I think, that the left left is not always as good as it should be at realizing that sometimes we're just going to disagree.
Yeah,
people just legitimately are going to have different opinions, and we'll argue it out, and the majority get their way because that's how democracy works.
Yeah,
but you don't have to think they were right, and you can still,
and you don't have to split off and form an even smaller party that will get even less votes.
Yeah, but I mean, I think part of the reason why the left finds it easy to split is that if you think of it like the formation of the planets in the early solar system, then if you've got some lump that's big, so it's got a lot of gravity, then other things fall in with it, and it all merges together. And little things find it hard to stay away because it's got a lot of gravity, and that ends up being the Earth or Jupiter or whatever. And where that doesn't happen, where there's just little lumps that bounce off each other and none of them's got much gravity, you've got the asteroid belt.
Right.
And that's the left. that actually no group... Because you saw when Corbynism started, lots of people joined the Labour Party who've never been Labour members. I mean, some of them might have regretted it since. Lots of people joined the Labour Party, lots of people, because they thought, I was getting somewhere, so we will row in behind it. And the left at the moment, if you're in a party that's got 100 members and you're always in the 40 who lose all the votes, then why not split? Why is it worse really being in a party of 40 than in a party of 100? It's not much worse. You know, it's the same. And so you can keep splitting. And then if you're in the 15 who always lose the votes in the party of 40, then you can split. Then we've got the really pure line. And I mean, I can see why people do it. I don't think it's I don't think it's malice, and I don't think it's just silliness. It doesn't happen with other political forces because they've got something that's got enough gravity.
Right.
That if you're broadly in the space of green politics, that even if you hate the leadership of the Green Party, even if you think it gets stuff wrong, you'll probably still think, yeah, but I can get more done as a minority in the Green Party.
Right.
Than I could breaking away from it and launching my own Green Party brackets ML. And it's the same with the Scottish National Party or whatever like that.
Yeah.
And so those are proper planets and we're an asteroid belt. But I think the left is not all going to completely unite because somebody tells it to. But I think the minimum thing about the election that it should be possible to do is to say, if my own group or the group that I support doesn't have a candidate round here, then, okay, I'll help out with your group.
Yeah, but also not to try and subvert that group, not to connive against them, but to throw yourself wholeheartedly behind that.
Yeah, yes, and do it. And I am not currently part of a left group, but I've campaigned for various different organizations. And yeah, you try to do it honestly and say the arguments that you think are their position. And if we did that, then the number of constituencies where we would have a reasonable chance of having a go at it would be a lot bigger, because there's not many constituencies where one group is going to have the numbers to do a serious campaign. But if they could just agree, you know, sure, there's still stuff we disagree about. We still think our own is the best. But if we've got our own candidate, then we'll work for our own candidate. But if in this city we're not strong enough to put up a candidate and you aren't having a go at it, then we'll get in behind it for the sake of the election. Because the fact that we have a different interpretation of the transitional program from you isn't quite the same as the difference between us and Starmer or us and the Tories.
No.
Some people on that field think that's much more important.
Yes. No, indeed. Well, have to deal with them, won't we?
We will.
When we come to them. any other words of wisdom then?
I don't think these have been words of wisdom.
It's more sensible than, you know, I've heard them from a lot of people, I think.
Well, I mean, thank you. Honestly, it took me long enough to work out any of these things. If you'd asked me a few years ago, I would probably have said, oh, yeah, send loads of candidates. Let's get the argument out there. And I gradually came to realize you're not getting the argument out then if nobody actually hears it. And it feels as though, you know, as though it's being defeatist or saying we can't achieve the revolution tomorrow. But actually, I think there are no shortcuts at the moment. There are real ways forward, as you've been saying, that there is a political space to the left. There are lots of people who were enthused by Corbyn or by the movement around Corbyn, who supported Labour because it seemed to represent something more to the left. And so that support is potentially there. But it takes day-to-day work to make it a reality or to make it politically effective.
I think you made a point about names as well, didn't you? That there's one thing you said, what was that?
Yeah, and this is something that left groups do, is stand under names that they've made up for the particular election rather than under their real name. I mean, I think I say in that article, I think if you ask members of the public to name a far-left organization, they would say either Militant or the SWP. But the name Militant has only ever appeared on the ballot paper in one constituency in a general election. It actually got 6,500 votes or something. And the name Socialist Workers Party has never, in a general election, appeared on a ballot paper. Not that those organizations don't stand candidates, but they stand them under different names that they've made up. There are constituencies where in the last 20 or 25 years, the same person has stood in different elections under three different party names, while actually being part of the same group. And I don't think that's the way to build up
no.
support base.
No.
I mean, I think if you've got a name that the public might recognize, you know, name recognition is difficult to get if you're a minor.
Yeah.
If you've got a name like Militant, I think if they would stand, or the organization that's the successor of that, if they put Militant on the ballot paper, then I think there might be something where they're kind of at this point.
Yeah.
After what I've seen, I'm voting Militant because they've heard of it. That obviously some people would hear the name Militant and be put off by it. Some people don't. Look, but that's true of Conservative. That's true of Labour. It's true of any party name that some people support it and some people don't. But I think it's better to use the real name, and it's better to use the name that you use in your day-to-day campaigning and in your political work.
Absolutely.
Because if you've been active in local struggles or in campaigns or whatever it might be, and you've been doing that under a particular name, then why stand as United Socialist, this, that, and the other, which nobody's ever heard of, instead of the name that people might have seen...
Yeah. I think that's so. I mean, it's a sort of ignorance, isn't it, of the way the world, you know, advertising works for a reason, really. Your branding works for a reason. It's not capitalist nonsense. Well, it is, but it's also important. I remember reading somewhere years ago hearing that the firm Rent-A-Kill, they hate that name. The executives and that, they're like, oh, man, I work for Rent-A-Kill. I don't want to, you know. But they can't change it because it so powerfully represents what they do. And also, you know, it's so well known that they can't change it. They're stuck with it, you know.
Yeah. And it's quite right, because if they changed the name, nobody would ever have heard it.
No, of course not.
And how would you ever build up? The advertising budget doesn't exist in the world to build up that.
No, I'm particularly on the left, we don't have that.
No, and we don't have it.
No.
So if you've got name recognition, then making it, oh, no, this election we're going to be Socialist Alternative, and then next time we're going to be Socialist Alliance, and next time we're going to be... Don't do that.
Yeah.
And I think that's just not... That's not sensible politics, and it wouldn't be for any party.
Yeah. I agree. Well, I mean, unless you've got any other, I see, that might do us for now. Dr. Griffiths, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on, Alexis.
So, yeah, I mean, an amazing interview, I think, and a road forward. This will be the moment you will listen to this podcast and you will say to yourself, this is the moment my life changed.
Mm-hmm.
This is the moment when I rediscovered hope and became active again. Come on, people, let's do this shit.
Fucking A, rise up.
Rise up, man. But, you know, like in a focused way, not just in that sort of... generic kind of, you know, people, we all got to be together kind of nonsense. I mean, you know, he's come in now.
Wilf is rising up. He's into it. Yeah. Is he holding a little placard? He's marching up and down behind you. He's doing a little...
Yes.
Protest.
Yes.
Says down with the bastard Labour right on his placard.
Yeah.
Get organised. Yes, Wilf. That's right.
Gosh.
That's absolutely right.
Teddy's doing a podcast.
While Wilf is, I just heard the last thing Wilf just said, and he said, if you want to help us keep making podcasts like this and bringing more content to you that is not like anything any other podcast is doing, then please help us out. Go to our Patreon, patreon.com/AlexisLPodcast, from as little as £2 a month. I don't know. It's that they're not subscribing to the Patreon, Linda. £2 a month, or 5 or 10 or 20. But like, you know, help us out, create more stuff for you. The more we get on the Patreon, the more time I can spend producing and helping Alexi make this. It means a lot, though. Everyone who is a member there, they're so cool. They send messages. They give us their praises and their solidarity. There is some stuff on the Patreon that only Patreon members get access to, and there will be more, I promise, on its way. So, you know, keep that up. Visit the site, have a look, see if you fancy giving £2, even just for a couple of months, and then leaving. That's fine. Thanks for the support, Wilf, and for helping me plug the Patreon. And we'll be back soon with another one. We've already got another one in the bag.
Yeah, yeah.
More revolutionary talk.
Yes, it's true. All right. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the AlexisL podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at AlexisLPodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.